we have been amidst a kinetic war started by Russia, an ongoing geopolitical crisis.
How can we protect our physical assets that are connected? Because everything is now connected. And just how are we going to harden and protect all of these assets from cyber capabilities? And I don't see that really changing.
And when it comes to war, as the war continues, what are the key lessons to be learned?
So I used to be a C-130 pilot in the U.S. Air Force, and a few years ago, I switched over into cyber warfare in the Air Force, and then I got out now 3 years ago, and I've been teaching cybersecurity and most recently working as a sales engineer selling cybersecurity products.
And since your background is cyber warfare, let's start with cyber warfare. Okay. So we have been amidst a kinetic war started by Russia, an ongoing geopolitical crisis. According to Japan Times, this is what they say, and I quote, "In many aspects, the cyber war from Russia has so far been the dog that didn't bark." And even though that may be an exaggeration, and Russia did engage in cyber activity, but the impact has been much different from what that has been originally anticipated or envisioned, as of what I mentioned earlier.
Yeah.
And even according to one of the papers from Carnegie, Russia has achieved far less via cyber warfare in Ukraine than many Western countries expected. So I want to ask you, what really happened? I mean, in your experience, what part has cyber war really played in the ongoing geopolitical crisis? And what are the key lessons to be learned from that?
So this one's been interesting for me. I actually studied Russian language and at the Air Force Academy. And I was supposed to spend a semester in Russia. While that didn't end up happening, I've been following this closely. But the Russian military is very interesting machine, if you will. They have traditionally been a conscript military where everyone of a certain age, if they're eligible, gets pulled into the military. And it's very, very recently, I believe in like the last 10 to 15 years, that that has changed to a more voluntary military, much like what the United States and a lot of the rest of the Western world has, where it's people sign up to join the military if they want to, which is like the case for me and a lot of other U.S. veterans. Basically, since the Vietnam War, we've been a voluntary force. So it's changing where with conscripts, you don't have necessarily a professional military because people come in and they leave. It works really well if you need bodies to hold rifles and hold a line and do a thing. And you can train them up to a certain technical aspect to fly planes or drive tanks or do cybersecurity, but you rarely see professionals who stay in for 20, 30, 40 years. The U.S. military, we tend to stay until about 20 years is kind of the max, unless someone becomes a general or a colonel and they stay in longer. But that's just the life cycle. The average is supposed to be about 3 to 4 years where people come in and then they leave. When you've got everyone that comes in for 2 to 3 to 4 years and then leaves, you just don't see a lot of professional growth. And when it transitioned from conscripts to voluntary professional, some things changed where they did become a little more professional. I know on the aviation side, we saw a drop and then a rise in some of their capabilities. And I think a lot happened in the same way with cybersecurity, where they were able to enlist, if you will, or pull in some people who had more talent and train them up in a certain way. And I think we saw a lot of that with NotPetya in 2013, 2014. And I think they lost grasp of a lot of their forces since then. And a lot of those folks with technical expertise moved into the cybercrime realm.
And you raise a really interesting point there, because this thing of like cyber war and more becoming cybercrime and changing in that direction and how NotPetya happened is totally different than what we could have imagined with the full-blown invasion of it not really going in that direction, because the effects of NotPetya were seen in the world. It was targeting Ukraine, but it actually impacted, at the end of the day, the entire world. So many organizations and big conglomerates and 800 of mesh ships coming to a standstill, dead in water. And when it comes to war, as the war continues, in my experience, not personal experience, but in my ideology, I see two biggest risks from cyber war that can be leveraged more successfully than others. A, threat intelligence, which could represent the biggest cyber risk towards the target. For example, Russian hackers collecting high-value intelligence that, for example, Moscow can then leverage effectively. Specific example being the hackers might actually obtain real-time geolocation data that may then enable the assassination or timely and accurate targeting of the Ukrainian forces, particularly those with high-value weapons and systems. That's one of the risks. The other is I see going forward is precisely what you said, leveraging cyber criminals and cyber criminal gangs. And even though maybe we didn't see Russia doing too much of that in this invasion, particularly, we have seen examples of this. And I think the trend will just continue to grow where nation states are hiring and leveraging cyber criminals in return for safety, money, profit, or whatever, as a key part of their cyber war strategy, especially when you say in terms of losing talent, because ultimately it's a talent game and how much you can invest and how much you can just buy of talent, right? Especially cyber criminals right. that want money, right? So you get a win-win in that case. Mm-hmm. So in your experience, how do you see this geopolitical dynamics that we have been seeing affect the cyber warfare posture going forward? How does the future of cyber war look like?
I don't see it changing that drastically from how we've been preparing for the past few years. So I had my primary role switched to cybersecurity soon after NotPetya. And that was one of the big concerns was how can we protect our physical assets that are connected, because everything is now connected. The C-130s were connected and we worried about data links and just how are we going to harden and protect all of these assets from cyber capabilities. And I don't see that really changing, whether it's going to be through nation state actors or cyber criminals, they're going to still leverage the same capabilities. You're just going to see differences in resources and funding, depending on if they're making money off of ransomware and targeting based on that. That's one thing. If it's a nation state actor targeting based off of capabilities and espionage, if you will, it's going to be a little different. But I think that's going to have to be quieter than what's been done in the past. I think NotPetya put too many eyes on, and the US has actually leveraged some capabilities against ISIS and ISIL a few years ago. There's an NPR article that actually goes into a lot of depth and actually has quotes and some real-time feedback from the team as that attack was happening. But you can see how in-depth and how much planning has to go into these, and understanding that when you use that capability, you've now shown the world exactly how it works and that whole toolkit. When that got released to the world, the NSA lost a bunch of tools and they were able to be used by cyber criminals. But at the same time, people were able to harden and strengthen their capabilities. And so any exploits that were being used by the government utilizing those tools then became a lot less effective. So if during this conflict, tools like that were to be used, now they've let the cat out of the bag on what their capabilities are. So it's a very expensive weapon that once you use becomes less effective.
Yeah, absolutely right. And I think that's very critical what you said right now, because there was one of these quotes from Rob Joyce that I read, which says Russia is like a hurricane and China is more like climate change, more pointing towards the fact that how Russia can be really sporadic and unorganized, but just trying to just get out. You said what happened with NotPetya, for example, right? Too many eyes just came upon that very fast, whereas China is more a long-term strategic threat. And I think you're absolutely spot on in the fact that going forward, probably and most likely needs to be a bit more quieter, especially when you want to have that bigger impact and you want to make sure that you're not exhausting your resources, especially when all these things come out. So on one hand, we've been talking a bit about it, right? On one hand, we have nation states who some of the biggest motivations or goals are espionage, political unrest, and disruption to critical infrastructure, and especially national security. Yep. That's on the one side. On the other extreme, we are really seeing just 18 years old getting hired into cyber criminal gangs, stealing data, selling it on the dark web, running organized cyber crime with ransomware affiliate programs, with ransomware as a service kits, and even customer service. I mean, incredible, right? Leading to an ever-growing underworld cyber crime ecosystem. Not just cybercrime, but cybercrime ecosystem. Yeah. For these cyber criminals, financial profit is still the number one motivation as opposed to the nation state attackers. Mm-hmm. In your experience, what are the top trends that you're seeing when it comes to cybercrime and especially data breaches?
I think targets might change and a lot more as a service might rise up. A lot of access as a service has been a thing for a while. Ransomware as a service has been a thing for a little while. I think a lot of those criminals are wanting to get less hands-on. They realize they can develop something, they can gain access, but they don't want to own the whole life cycle because then they can get shut down. They make less off the overall attack, but by creating more customers in their minds, they're able to make up for that loss in revenue, if you will. I think we're going to see more of that, where now looking at trying to figure out who the attackers are, what their tools are using, and who's responsible for what, and maybe even tying that back to state-sponsored criminal groups might be more difficult. And I wonder if a little bit of that is driven from strategy, from people who know a little bit more. You've mentioned it, and it's been quite apparent for a while. A lot of criminals, the average age is low 20s, because you've got teenagers and younger adults who are able to find these exploits, create criminal groups, and take advantage of things. And while there's criminals of all ages, and that just seems to be a trend for quite a while, I think that's going to continue because people see opportunities and they jump at them. Stability in the economy is going to drive a lot of that. So right now, inflation is huge all over the world. I think until that changes, we might see a rise in cybercrime as people look at their opportunities and realize it's going to be hard to get a job, but I have some skills and I know some people and I might be able to take advantage of that. I think that's a lot of what drives people is instability and fear. That's what drives a lot of people to criminal actions. And as long as the world remains unstable, that might be the case.
I still see and experience that security is still considered a cost center in majority of the organizations, unless you're really selling and gaining revenue from security services. And while we talk a lot more at least about security as a business differentiator, because that is literally the single biggest factor that I believe for security to either win or not win. If it's not a business differentiator, it's absolutely a big loss. But not every organization really implements or even understands security as an enabler. And I wish to ask you something more personal, something that you have experienced in your life and in your journey. Have you encountered one or two real examples in your journey that you can share with us where security failed to be used because it was a hindrance, because it was a roadblock, because it was not a real business differentiator? What were your key lessons from those stories, from those incidents?
So this one is might be upsetting, especially based on what we've been recently talking about. But while I was in the Air Force, I was a flight commander at the 1st Special Operations Communication Squadron. And the Air Force had been piloting a program for internal pen testing. And our base was chosen to be one of the bases to participate in the pilot program. And so they sent a whole bunch of equipment, a whole pallet full of servers and software that was part of this whole toolkit that we were supposed to use to pen test the network, maybe some of the OT on base. But we needed authority to operate, and that came from the base commander, from the wing commander, who at that base, their mission, their operations, we're all on, it's a special operations base. So providing special operations, air warfare capabilities to our fighters overseas, to our bases overseas. And their concerns when it came to our squadron were access to the internet, access to file servers, and access to email. And so we weren't able to get our authorization to operate because the wing commander wouldn't sign off on it. And the reason that he wouldn't sign off on it was because he wanted us to spend our resources focusing on availability. And truth be told, he said, if we had a week where there was no problems with email, there was no problems across the base with people getting to the internet, he'd sign off on our ATO. And it never happened in the time that I was around there for a couple of years. There's a lot of moving parts in there, but it comes back to, if we're not able to give the value of what we're doing as cybersecurity operators, as cyber professionals, then we're going to get in our own way.
So that's really incredible story that you shared with us, Josh. I mean, the importance of it is just so critical, especially when it comes to Air Force and military and so on. What did you think was the biggest challenge there?
Yeah, so it's a very difficult thing. The Air Force is made up of pilots. And at the general ranks, the top, the leadership, it's almost 95% pilots. When I graduated from the Air Force Academy, we knew there were 50 generals in the Air Force from 1-star to 4-star. There's only 50 billets. Those are given out by Congress and they're very special. So the numbers don't change that much. Of those, most of them are fighter pilots, bomber pilots, or cargo pilots. And they make decisions based off of getting planes in the air, what makes us lethal, what makes us safe, and usually in that order. And it creates a certain perspective that is hard for us to put things in their words. Fortunately, coming from being a pilot, moving to cyber warfare in the Air Force, I was actually able to make a lot of those connections and explain things in a way that made sense to folks. But generally, just like, how does getting new tires on the buses on the base, how does that end up with us getting planes in the air? It doesn't necessarily make a lot of sense to pilots, but it's something that has to happen. They see the same thing happening with like this pen test equipment. Like, how is that going to allow us to keep planes in the air? And this is the same case that we have to make in business. But I had the fortunate or unfortunate case of having to try to make this in the Air Force. And we have to make the correlation to cyber of this is how we make flying happen. And then this is how we keep planes in the air. And it's hard to see until an event makes it very apparent. In the United States, we didn't know that our intelligence was not good at communicating to one another or that we weren't protecting these assets until September 11th happened. And then there was a whole committee that went back and went, oh yeah, we could do this better. One of my first jobs in the Air Force, once I became a pilot, because you have to have additional jobs, was to be a safety officer. And so I went to Aircraft Mishap Investigation School and spent a month and a half learning how to investigate aircraft crashes. And in that, we looked at from the beginning of aviation to where we are now, how many people had to die and how many planes had to crash before we put in things at the FAA level or at the manufacturer level or at the Air Force operations level. And things where, unfortunately, I had to watch videos of people who we kind of knew put their planes into the ground or get shot down and go back and reverse engineer that to understand, okay, well, what got them to that location? And so there's a lot of things about automation and navigation and defenses, things that we've put into aircraft to make them safer. And they're very, very safe now than they were 20, 30, 40 years ago. But how do we harden this now for cybersecurity? How do we protect it? How do we keep our planes and our data links from getting hacked? How do we keep our ground stations? And we know in cybersecurity that it's not about getting to the plane. We just saw Southwest, an airline in the United States, their database got scrambled and they had to cancel flights for like 5 days across the United States. My last week is technically filling in a pilot job before I switched, there was a Symantec antivirus update or a McAfee update that blocked a port. The rule changed, it blocked a port. And everyone in the world was like, okay, sure, that's fine. The Air Force automatically updated to the latest versions because patches went out across the weekend. People came in on Monday and pilots weren't able to use their flight prep mission preparation software because the tool needed that port. And now by default, it was blocked across the Air Force network. And the people who, you know, should check patches and find out, okay, patch management, how do we set these things up? They could have checked those things. We basically DDoSed ourselves and they had to find a workaround until they could revert or change things. And I didn't see how it ended up working out. It ended up working out. But I do know that even on our base, I wasn't the tech guy. I was leaving and like wasn't really in the office that week, but they were scrambling to find computers that were air gapped and hadn't been updated and use those just to get planes off the ground. You don't need to attack the plane if you can attack the things low level that just make it so you can't take off the planes. And until that gets translated and explained to the people who handle the budget, handle the, you know, people operations, we need people to do these roles, till they understand that assets need to be allocated in a certain way to protect us at that point, it's hard. It's not going to happen. So
yeah,
that's one of my cases. I hope to make that message, and I've tried, and I'm going to continue to try because I think it's really important.
It's incredible, incredible story, Josh. Absolutely incredible. I mean, no better example have I heard where you can talk and showcase the importance of translating not only just what cybersecurity can mean for your business, in this case for Air Force, but also to do it in the right way so you're not shooting yourself in the foot. I mean, absolutely incredible story, Josh. Thank you so much today, Josh, for your valuable experience, your stories. It was really a pleasure having you in the podcast show today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. Thank you for driving the conversation so well.
That was today's episode of Monica Talk Cyber. I hope you had really fun listening to the conversation. You were inspired, and it will be touching into different topics that can help you both break into this industry, also grow into this industry. And I'll be back with more amazing conversations, more fantastic guests. Until then, please continue tuning in, subscribe to Monica Talk Cyber, stay safe, and I'll talk to you very soon.